This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You have heard me talk about therapy for a long time and BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love this service when they use it. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. You just answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and switch therapists at any time if it's not the right fit. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally, and the consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/runawaycountry. That's betterhelp.com/runawaycountry. Hi, everyone. Up until pretty recently, Donald Trump had shown an uncanny understanding of how his supporters saw the world. Whether it was mass deportations or isolationist foreign policy, Donald Trump had an innate connection to the MAGA brain. He knew what it wanted, what it would abide, and what it would not. Well, not anymore. In the last few months, Trump has made some fairly shocking miscalculations. The war with Iran, idiotic trade battles with important U.S. allies, a focus on ballrooms and helipads. Those priorities have shown just how entirely out of step this president is, especially with the people who matter most to Trump. But this week, Trump staked out one of his most unpopular positions yet.
And I can say if I were the mayor of a town or the governor of a state, and I had a chance to get a big plant in, an AI plant or a data center, I would absolutely want it because the jobs are enormous and the money paid, the taxes paid are just enormous.
Donald Trump, champion of the AI data center. AI data centers are those very large, mostly windowless buildings that house computer servers, storage drives, and hardware, and basically make the internet run. In his support of these centers, Donald Trump is very much alone. Last month, an Annenberg survey found that 61% of Americans say they'd oppose a new data center being built in their area. That is up from 49% in just March. Gallup, meanwhile, estimates the number of Americans who oppose these centers to be even higher, at 7 in 10. Now, okay, you might say, but exactly who is so opposed to these data centers? Is this just an issue on the far left? A concern for Bernie Sanders and AOC?
Ask Peter Thiel, ask Elon Musk, ask Mark Zuckerberg if they want one of these data centers in their own backyard. Ask any one of us here on this committee.
But you would be wrong to think that the issue of data centers is a fringe concern. In fact, if there is one thing we are learning in this season of national discontent, it is that some of the central issues being litigated on the 2026 campaign trail and very likely into the 2028 presidential cycle include the power of corporations, big tech's impact on communities, and the threat of artificial intelligence. And all of that anxiety is converging in the debate over data centers. You can see just how important the issue is becoming in real time. Last year, Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro celebrated a $20 billion Amazon data center investment in his state. But this month, Governor Shapiro has taken a very different position.
I've read your comments. I've seen your texts. I've listened to your phone calls. And I've talked with so many of you in person all across Pennsylvania. You don't want these irresponsible, burdensome, reckless AI data centers in your community. And I want you to know, I hear you.
Over in Ohio, Sherrod Brown, the former Democratic senator now running to reclaim his seat, has spent millions of dollars in ads painting his rival, Republican Senator John Husted, as the face of data centers. In Michigan, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed got the winning edge in his Democratic Senate primary after calling for state and federal moratoriums. Tom Tiffany, the Republican nominee for Wisconsin governor and, by the way, a close Trump ally, has been running attack ads against his Democratic opponent, Dave Crowley, over, you guessed it, Crowley's position on data centers.
Data center David Crowley. Big tech wins. Wisconsin pays.
In Wyoming, Republican Chuck Gray won the primary for his state's open house seat with a campaign against data centers and a call for a federal ban. But nowhere is this issue more alive than in the state of Texas. Last year, Republican Governor Greg Abbott said he wanted to make Texas the epicenter of AI development. He wasn't far off from that goal because there are an estimated 248 data centers planned for the state, in addition to the existing 335, according to the Texas Tribune. So yeah, up until very, very recently, Texas was very much in the business of big tech. Until Governor Abbott realized, amid widespread public outcry, that it very well might doom his reelection. Here he is on Sunday on ABC's This Week.
I have pressed pause on any new data center. If you're a data center and you want to operate in Texas, you have to first get the approval of those in local communities.
Greg Abbott and his fellow Republicans up and down the ticket are rapidly coming to the realization that even in the reddest parts of a pretty red state, data centers could be the thing that makes or breaks a campaign. And so now, as Democrats give these centers the cold shoulder, the Republican Party is racing to catch up. Yes, Donald Trump may still be basking in the warm glow of big tech, but the rest of the GOP is quickly understanding that when it comes to the infrastructure of artificial intelligence, you're either with the people or very much against them. I'm Alex Wagner, and this week on Runaway Country, how data centers took over the 2026 election to become a major concern for both parties, and what Republicans can do about the guy at the top of the party who still wants to see more of them. To understand this issue and its myriad dimensions, I will be talking to the brilliant Charlie Worzell, who writes about technology for The Atlantic and hosts the very, very excellent podcast, Galaxy Brain.
We have had, for the past 15 years, the incursion of big tech on all aspects of our life, except really for the physical one, right? They're just in every corner. They're surveilling us. They're, you know, extracting our attention. And the data centers are the physical manifestation in our lives. Like, they're coming to town.
But first, I wanted to speak to someone on the front lines of the war against data centers. Suzanne Bell Snyder runs the Texas Rural Reporter Substack from the Lone Star State's Panhandle. A Republican and former campaign staffer for Governor Greg Abbott, she is now traveling around the state, fighting the intrusion of these data centers on rural Texans' way of life, and she has got a lot to say about the governor's reversal. Here's our conversation. It is great to have you on the podcast. Thank you for doing this. I'm so eager to get your thoughts on what's happening down there in Lone Star State. You run a news site called the Texas Rural Reporter. First, props to doing that. I'm all for local journalism. But rural Texas is the sort of hotbed for this big debate over AI data centers. Just give me a sense of the lay of the land. What's it like down there as this debate rages on?
It's kind of wild, to be quite honest. What is happening with these data centers is absolutely the wild, wild west. Like, I've never seen anything like it. I have been doing what I call a dirt road tour. And so I drive across the state. I've been doing it for a year now. In the last 2 months, there is construction everywhere, all over rural Texas. I mean, we are being overtaken by these things. And so I think all you're seeing in like the polling and what the community's kind of coming at, you know, all the anxiety, is just because this is like a real thing that's like impacting these rural communities in a way that is just, it's absolutely insane.
What is it? I mean, you say they're everywhere. What is it? I mean, what does it look like? They're huge, right? They're really gigantic sort of superstructures.
They're very large. They're plopped down into like, you know, nature, the middle of agricultural communities. And so they're these, they don't even fit the landscape. So that's part of it, is they really do stick out. Cranes, you've got trucks everywhere, you know, crazy traffic. There's a highway 287 runs through the Texas Panhandle. If you drive from where I live, way up at the very top of the Panhandle to Dallas, you're going to go by like six data centers.
Wow.
It's crazy.
You mentioned that they're eyesores, right? They stick out. Is like, when you're experienced talking to people and living there, what is what is the thing that bothers people the most about their physical presence? They also make noise, right?
Yes, there's noise. They, you know, are taking from our water. They're mm-hmm. taking electricity. I think something that's interesting to think about rural communities is, in a lot of ways, we live in scarcity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so we live in the margins. So any little thing that happens in our community is very disruptive. And I'm actually very pro economic development. Like, I'm a Republican, I'm conservative. I've been, you know, I grew up in a red rural county. I mean, like 80% Republican voting county, right? That's where I live now. I've worked for a lot of these Republican candidates. But this kind of economic development is just too much, too big, too fast. And for a little place like where I live, it's really overwhelming and disruptive to our lives. Mm-hmm. You have single moms being kicked out of their apartment so that a data center construction worker can live there because they're jacking up rents like 3 times. I mean, this is stuff that's just, it's just wild. The data centers just don't fit. They don't fit the rural economic development model. And that's why they're so disruptive.
I mean, there's been through history, right? Economic development, there have been manufacturing hubs, there have been warehouses, there have been, you know, plants that have come up in rural areas, but this feels really different. Do you think it's because of the AI part of it specifically? Is it the technology that people are extra skeptical of?
I think that's part of it, yes, is that I have had this conversation with my dad. He's like in his 70s, right? And he's never lived anywhere except for, you know, our little town. He's a farmer. So part of the question is, like, what is this, right? Because in rural places, like, we're producers. Like, we make mm-hmm. things, we grow things, we create things. And so, like, part of the question is, you know, what is this data? And then why so fast? Why so big? Why, you know, there's a lot of whys surrounding it for sure. But I think the other side of this is just purely what these data centers are in the communities. You know, things like windmills, even oil and gas, manufacturing, those kinds of projects give more back to the community than they're taking. Mm. And I don't think that we've seen that these communities are really getting anything back from these data centers. And so I think that there's sort of two pretty big pieces to this. And that's what's driving, all of this anxiety around this.
I'm not sure that ChatGPT is like the application that everybody's using, but I mean, a large part of it is making the internet go. Do people think there's any utility in it? I'm just trying to understand. Like, they know generally that it's for tech, for the internet. But they don't place the same weight on that as like a manufacturing hub or like a, you know, an assembly line, because it's not tangible to them. Is that what it is?
Probably, yes. I mean, I would, you know, my dad doesn't use ChatGPT. So,
right.
You know, I do. I use it, a little. I use it as a productivity tool for my business because I'm a small business owner. So there are some benefits and values. But yeah, I think that is part of it, is that it's not, they don't see the value in what we're creating with these data centers and they just see what the drain on the resources mm-hmm. and sort of impact on our way of life is. And so the balance is just, I mean, it's off. That's really probably a lot more than anything to do with it.
It seems to me that one of the exacerbating factors would be the fact that, you know, these projects are often secret. People have to sign NDAs. They're targeting specifically rural communities because they think there's less oversight, there's less community engagement. It seems like the tech companies really miscalculated, though, on that front. Can you talk to me about what it has been like to see communities come together and say, not in our backyard?
So I believe there has been rural anger sort of growing over the last couple of years. I started writing my Substack in, I think it's 23.
Early adopter.
Yes. And I was, yeah, I'm not fan. I didn't even know what it was. I was like, ooh, this is a really neat thing.
I'm in.
I can give everyone in the world my opinion on this little platform. So some of it is just this growing frustration. And in Texas, I'll speak to Texas in particular, because we literally my part of the state is the actual, like, it's like ground zero. Like, it's insane how much is happening here. So this rural frustration, and then this sort of growing sort of disconnect between policymakers and rural communities, I think, mm-hmm. is behind a lot of it. in Texas, in particular, I'll talk to that. I'll speak to the Governor Abbott kind of component, which we've seen in the last couple of days that Governor Abbott's all against data centers now, when literally welcomed, you know, them to Texas and asked us to be the epicenter of AI data centers. And so there's this frustration is growing. The state of Texas, under Abbott's leadership, has welcomed data centers. He has, they've built policies, they've given tax breaks. But at the same time, something else has been happening that I think is where a lot of the, you know, the anger out of rural Texas is coming, is that they've also been trying to centralize government control in Austin, and they've been slowly chipping away at local control. And so this issue, you literally have seen sort of, those two issues have kind of come together around data centers in particular because of what you just said, which is, you know, we don't have a lot of zoning laws because we are a pro, like, property rights state, right? So we don't want the government in our business. I mean, my family's owned land for 100 years. I don't want the government telling me, you know, what I can do with that land. And that's sort of what's driven this, you know, policy decisions that have been made about no zoning and things like that. And so you've really created a dynamic where it's like local government versus the state in a lot of places. And that's what's happening here. The state's, you know, recruited all of these data centers, and then they've given local governments zero tools, like, whatsoever. The only tool they have is an abatement, which, and these economic development sort of, you know, contracts, I guess you would call them. But abatements, you pretty much have to give them some kind of a tax break to be able to even negotiate those projects coming to the committees. So it's a completely messed up system. And so I think that there's a lot of trust amongst local government. So, I mean, I know my county judge, I know my commissioners, I see them on a, you know, weekly basis, daily basis, I see them at church. So there's a conversation there. And so when they start signing NDAs and things like that, it's a break of trust. And it's like a real, like, all of these communities are built on trust, you know, and relationships. And so, but it's really a dynamic that Austin created because we just don't, they just don't have any other tools available to them.
More of my conversation with Suzanne Bell Snyder right after the break. Runaway Country is brought to you by Act Blue. If you've been listening to this podcast, you already know the stakes. Act Blue is a platform that's been powering Democratic campaigns for over two decades, giving candidates up and down the ballot the tools they need to fundraise, organize, build websites, and win. And this year, they've launched an organizing platform built specifically for the people doing the work, Act Blue Field Tools. Taking back the House and winning local elections across the country does not start in October. It happens now, in the doors knocked and phone calls made by volunteers this summer. That energy is out there, and Act Blue Field Tools is built to mobilize it at scale. It's already helped more than 350,000 volunteers get to work across all 50 states, handling texting, phone banking, and canvassing, so your team can focus on what actually moves voters, meaningful conversations with real people. Plus, all of the features work together in one platform, making it easier than ever to mobilize your community wherever you are. Act Blue never sells your data or personal information, so you can stay focused on what matters most: donating, organizing, and helping Democrats win. This November, the elections could come down to just a few hundred votes. The work that wins those races starts this summer, and it starts with you. Get started at actblue.com/crooked. Runaway Country with Alex Wagner is brought to you by Wild Alaskan Company. I feel so much better when I eat delicious, healthy, sustainable food. Wild Alaskan Company offers the best way to get wild-caught, high-quality seafood delivered to your door on your schedule. Each box comes with individually portioned fillets, which are vacuum-sealed and easy to prep. All the fish is quick-frozen, fresh from Alaskan waters, which helps lock in its freshness and texture and flavor and key nutrients like omega-3s. It's fish you can trust with no GMOs, antibiotics, or other additives. Every order supports sustainable harvesting practices and the Alaskan fishermen whose history is tied to the region and the practice. I told you once, I told you again, I love the salmon. You put some teriyaki on that, maybe some miso, maybe just a nice herbed butter. marinate it, grill it, you can't lose. Wild Alaskan Company is so confident that their fish is the best that they offer a 100% satisfaction and money-back guarantee, so you can try that first box risk-free. Go to wildalaskan.com/Alex for $35 off your first order of premium wild-caught seafood. That's wildalaskan.com/Alex for $35 off your first order. Thank you to Wild Alaskan for sponsoring this episode. Are you, you mentioned Governor Abbott in all of this, who's the architect of much of this development. He's now doing really like a U-turn on this. Are people buying it? I mean, he's in a race, and there's some reporting that there are deep red Texas Republicans who are willing to vote Democrat on this issue specifically.
I don't think people are buying it. So I'll tell you what I know about his flip-flop on data centers. I actually got, there's been surveys running in rural Texas around the governor's race, data centers, and vouchers. And so some of this started, just to point that out, some of this started last election cycle when Governor Abbott went and targeted 16 rural Republicans who would not vote for his voucher bill. And literally spent he put about $1 million in each of those races against the opponents of sitting Texas House members. And so you've had this thing building. I mean, we don't do we don't even have private schools anywhere around us. We're not going to be able to utilize a voucher. And so these rural Republicans sort of got voted out. So there's another, like, there's sort of this like political level there that had, that's part of that build up, you know, towards all of that. So people were already angry at Abbott over that. And so now you've got this, and then you've had Abbott talking about property tax, a lot of issues that matter to people. Mm-hmm. He's been there for 12 years and there's been no movement on it. So we know they polled. I got the poll myself, and that was confirmed by some folks in Austin that shared some information with me, that his whole data center piece was built on the fact that their polling came back that rural communities were, that Republicans were losing rural communities over this data center issue. So it's real.
Yeah, well, it's a national issue. And as you say, you guys are the sort of ground zero for this debate. And it sounds like people are going to maybe punish the Republican who made a lot of this happen, even though he's trying to sort of change his tune, I guess, in the closing months of the race. One of the things that is interesting to hear, because I know we're talking about a conservative part of the country, but what is being demanded is like stronger oversight, greater citizen input, accountability, you know, maybe some regulation. Like, it's, these are not your typical conservative talking points. And that is, like, this issue is really unique in that way. And it's really bipartisan in a way that I can't think of literally any other issue in America.
Right.
What is it like? I am sure in your reporting and in your experience, you've come across people from very much the other side of the coin in terms of politics. What is that like?
It's interesting because this issue came out of left field. I mean, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, I would have never told you that this would be the issue of, yeah. You know, but what I think is what this issue is built around in a lot of ways is like the stewardship issue, is that that's a place where conservatives and liberals can agree. Like, we've been given land and we're supposed to steward it in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I think this data center issue is like sort of the, you know, it's the thing that makes us all question, are we really doing what we're supposed to be doing with this land? And I think that's why, like, I think you can see some agreement. If, you know, the problem for Democrats in Texas, and this, in particular, Gina Hinojosa, in my opinion, is that, you know, unfortunately, she's got the trifecta of, you know, reasons why a conservative, you know, she's Hispanic, she's a woman, and she's a Democrat. Like, it's very hard for, you know, a typical conservative, like, to, you know, say,
three strikes, in other words, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
But you do, I mean, there is reporting. I mean, and you tell me, you're there. There is the reporting that people are like, as you say, a woman, a Latina, and a Democrat, but people are willing to put aside their concerns about all three of those things and vote for her simply on the data center issue. Is that an overstatement?
It's not an overstatement. I believe those people exist. I believe also the dynamic is that you have those that may not actually flip to the other side, but they're not voting for Abbott. And so I think that the whole story of, you know, November 4th is going to be, what did rural Texas do? And did they stay home or did they flip? Because they are not enthusiastically turning out for Abbott anywhere in rural Texas. And that, you know, I go back to 2018 when Ted Cruz beat Beto O'Rourke for the Senate race in 2018. That was a similar situation with the Trump midterm. And Cruz won by 219,000 votes statewide.
Yeah, it was real narrow.
He spent the last week of the campaign, Cruz did, coming to places like Pampa, Texas, which is just 45 miles from me. I know because I went to his rally. The national media said, you're crazy. Why is Ted Cruz campaigning in rural Texas? Well, they did that because they had to. They had to have that rural margin to win that race. And I think that is where Abbott is sitting right now, and he knows it. They poll every single day. I mean, I used to be a part of that network. I worked in Austin for 20 years. I know how they operate, right? They poll every day. They know exactly what's happening, what people are thinking. And so what, you know, they've made a political flip because of that. I literally did an interview just an hour ago with a kind of an opinion leader in a rural community up here. And she said, people don't trust Abbott and they're not voting for him this time. Obviously, you know, I can't give you that's what everyone's thinking, but there is absolutely a group of people. And if it's 220,000 people that decide to stay home or flip, either to vote for Gina or somebody else, you know.
That's it. That's the ball game.
I don't know.
You think, Suzanne, I just got one more question for you. Like, there are over 300 data centers in the state. There's hundreds more that are planned. People are living with this reality. Do you imagine that this issue, which I agree with you, has come kind of out of nowhere, is going to be an issue in the 2028 presidential race? I mean, like, is the sort of matter settled once this election is over, or do you think it continues to be a source of anguish and debate?
I think it depends on what these legislators actually do. I mean, there's a lot of talk, you know, it feels like a 60-day, you know, conversation about data centers. But I think that what happens, you know, in rural Texas and with the rural vote, which I am actively going to pay attention to this cycle. We're actually trying to do a lot of work in that space at different levels and just really trying to understand Texas rural voters. But we've got a couple of projects that we're trying to run right now. I think that, you know, however legislators respond to this outrage, whether it's just we're going to get through the 60 days and we're going to go on as business as usual, which is what a lot of people think is going to happen, or they truly come in and try to put some, you know, stop gaps, you know, on these projects. But I mean, it's a complicated issue though, because we don't want to give away we don't want to give away property rights, you know? And so, you know, sometimes Alex, and this is going to sound probably horrible when I say it, but sometimes I think that these folks aren't actually even capable of solving these kinds of problems anymore.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I mean, part of the reason this has happened is that tech is moving so much faster than politicians can even conceive of the concerns.
Well, but beyond that, we're not electing policymakers anymore. We're electing these crazy, with these politicians that coalesce to these crazy ideas. We don't have any people in there that are serious about going in there and doing what's best for the people or communities anymore. And that's where my outrage has come from. It's like, where are the leaders? We've solved problems in America our entire existence. Maybe we didn't have social media and all this stuff to like, where we've turned our politicians into, you know, publicity figures. I mean, we've got to get back to doing good policies for the country. I mean, we're struggling. I mean, little towns like mine, I mean, I just wish they would come visit places like where I live, because we're struggling. We're having a hard time. You know, gas is too high. Groceries are too high. Housing's too high. Insurance is too high. And so there's a lot of things at play. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think that, you know, I don't have a lot of hope that we've got a group of legislators that are willing to really do the right thing anymore. I think we answer to our masters, and that's what's happening in, you know, in our politics these days. So until the people, which that's what I love about this movement. I mean,
yeah, that's the sort of answer to that malaise. Yeah.
Right.
The fact
this
that you, communities
about.
That were seen to be the ones that would lay down and stay quiet as big tech came in to try and develop these centers are not going quietly into that good night. And that is the essence of our democracy. So I get it. I mean, I'm as jaded as anybody out there, but I do find some like unusual hope in the bipartisan grassroots efforts that are being made to really hold people accountable for the decisions they're making on behalf of the American public. Suzanne, I love this conversation. Please tell me everything that is happening in Texas as you see it. Your insight is invaluable. And also your reporting, like everybody should go check out Rural Texas, the Texas Rural Reporter, when you have a moment to get your on the ground sort of assessment of what's going on. We are too siloed in terms of our information and perspective and analysis. And it's, you know, these kinds of conversations that give us real, you know, really help us understand the fabric of this great country. Suzanne, thank you for joining Runaway Country. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Alex. Anytime.
After the break, putting this all into context with Galaxy Brain host and Atlantic writer Charlie Warzel. But first, guys, my new book, The Steal, 4 Right-Wing Hardliners, 1 Republican Presidency, and the Raid on America's Courts, comes out September 15th, and you can pre-order it now if you want to hear more about the secret history behind the Supreme Court's very steep lurch rightward and the decades-long conservative plot to raid the bench. This book is for you. I'll be crisscrossing the country this fall with book events in New York with Melissa Murray and McNally Jackson Books on September 15th. I'll be in Los Angeles with John Lovett and Writer's Block on September 17th. And I will be in San Francisco with the great comedian and thinker Kamau Bell at the Commonwealth Club. So please check online for tickets and come out and say hi. Runaway Country is brought to you by Bookshop.org. Would you be surprised to learn that we're living in a resurgence of independent bookstores? More than 1,000 new stores have opened in the last 5 years. Independent bookstores do more than just sell books. They take care of and pour back into their communities, creating safe spaces that foster culture and curiosity and a love of reading. When you purchase from Bookshop.org, you're supporting more than 3,000 local independent bookstores so they can continue their essential work. I have right now just cracked open Yesteryear, like every other person on this planet, and I am not so far disappointed, and I bought it from Bookshop.org. Use code ALEX to get 10% off your next order at Bookshop.org. That is 10% off at Bookshop.org with the code ALEX. Today's show is sponsored by Strawberry.me. Have you ever written a review about a product or service you've used? You've got to be really pissed off or completely blown away by something to take the time and energy to write a review. That is why I was happy when I saw all the reviews, positive ones, for our sponsor, Strawberry.me, a site that matches you with a certified coach to help you with your career. Not just a few reviews, literally hundreds of them at strawberry.me/reviews. All unfiltered and glowing, one after another. My coach was amazing. The experience was transformative. I landed a new job within weeks. And how about this one? It helped transform me back into a high-powered leader following my extended maternity leave. Womp, womp. When so many people go out of their way to write a positive review about something, you know that something is special. So if you're feeling stuck at work, do what tens of thousands of people have already done. Go to strawberry.me/Alex and claim 50% off your first coaching session. That's strawberry.me/Alex. I think you're part of the two-timers club, Charlie. I think this is like your second time on Runaway Country and certainly not your last. When we decided we were going to try and tackle this topic, your name came up and I was like, bingo, bango, that's the guy we need. I'm thrilled that you're here to help enlighten me and offer some great, deep perspective, I'm sure. So thank you.
Happy to be here.
I've been avoiding this conversation for a really long time because I was like, oh God, AI, I can't. There seems like there's a lot there, and there obviously is. The conversation, the political engagement, the narrative around data centers has fucking exploded in what feels like the last several months, and specifically in the last week, right? Because we're seeing political fallout, in like meaningful political fallout for the first time, I think. People hate these data centers. It's hard to find someone other than Donald Trump who's willing to say they're a good idea. But like, let's just take a moment to unpack why people hate them. I mean, it sounds like on the surface, there's this sort of environmental energy utilities impact that people don't like, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the water usage is a thing people talk about, but water usage it sounds like it's a little bit overstated in terms of how much these things actually use because the water's recycled. But the utility thing is a considerable issue, is it not?
Yes. So the way that I've been describing these buildings, these data centers, which have been around for a while, by the way, like data centers are also how like you get Netflix, right? Or you access, all, like information on the internet. Like, and that's not to say that they haven't had problems for a while in different directions, but we have a conception nationally now of them as a very specific type of building. And it almost feels like they popped out of the national consciousness, you know, a year ago. And that obviously has to do with the AI boom. But I've been describing these buildings as like a national pain sponge, right? Or like kind of like a Rorschach test for every single American, in the sense that you show someone a picture of this data center and say, if you hate this, why do you hate this? And people give a lot of different reasons for it, right? There and almost all of them are in some way like really valid on the surface. They may not be, you know, the full picture, but they're very valid. So you have people who, you know, are very worried about the environmental concerns, right? Which is totally understandable. This is industry coming into towns. And, you know, historically, industries will come in and they'll do this type of construction. They'll eventually leave and there will be deposits of all kinds of, you know, things in the earth or groundwater or whatever. So there's an environmental concern there. There's an environmental concern with water usage, which while it has, these centers mostly have gotten better with that, they're doing what's called like closed loop cooling. So they're not pulling water out of the ground at the same rate. There's then the issue that closed loop cooling actually drives up electricity prices a lot by like 10 to 60%. So, you know, you're kind of lowering the environmental impact of one thing and then driving up costs and obviously electricity uses in its own way an environmental concern. You have a general, totally normal political issue of people building loud, noisy things in rural areas or in underserved communities, right? Which is a bothersome thing. You have garden variety NIMBYism, right? Just don't build it in my backyard. Yeah. We don't want it here. And then I think there is the issue of people who are concerned about artificial intelligence in general, right?
Yes. The more substantive, I mean, I'm not saying that the environmental and utility aspects aren't legitimate, but the substantive kind of almost psychological aspect to all of this, which is corporate distrust and a feeling that the corporations that are putting these in the ground are corrupt and that the technology itself, AI, is not necessarily for good and could actually maybe destroy humanity. How motivating do you think that is?
I think it's somewhat motivating. You know, there's a researcher, his name's Andy Masley, and he's done a lot of independent work. He's kind of started out checking the water usage stuff and showing that, you know, in his mind, some of these claims, didn't add up. But he's gone through the whole data center universe. And, you know, what he's shown in some of his research is that even though people are distrustful of big tech in certain ways, like they actually don't have, say, a bad view of Amazon, broadly speaking, like when you poll Americans, right. like they don't right. really mind Amazon.
They
right?
don't take away their Prime membership and it's a different story.
Right. And they don't mind the idea of Amazon distribution centers, right? Because they really serve them. And so what the argument that he made recently is that it doesn't fully track that this is just like we hate big tech or we hate AI. But I do think where I would disagree with him and other people who say this isn't really, you know, necessarily related to artificial intelligence as a technology, I think this whole issue is really wrapped up in a distrust, as you said, of like elites, oligarchy, concentration of wealth and power, and also a distrust specifically of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, totally.
Specifically of the leaders, specifically of the idea that these unelected people with tons and tons of power, not just monetary power, right? Not just extreme wealth, but also this ability to build and shape and change the platforms that all of our discourse is on all the
time.
There's this feeling that like the last 15 years of Silicon Valley products have not made us feel good about ourselves or made our politics feel good.
Charlie, we're recording this on a day when Meta has made a multi-billion dollar settlement for creating a product that has addicted children to it.
Right.
I mean, so yes, there is some reason for people to believe that the last 15 years of products out of Silicon Valley have not helped humanity.
Absolutely. I think one of the fundamental issues in this that supersedes all the rest of them is a sense right now, like a zero trust environment politically, but also with these companies. And I think there is a thought, I look at this from my perspective and having, you know, talked to lots of people about this, read all as much of the reporting as I can read from people on the ground, people who are opposing these projects. This feels like we have had for the past 15 years, the incursion of big tech on all aspects of our life, except really for the physical one, right? Mm-hmm. They're just in every corner. They're
yes.
surveilling us. They're, you know, extracting our attention. We feel like overly monetized, you know, to the hilt. We feel exhausted by their, you know, digital presence. And the data centers are the physical manifestation
totally.
In our lives. Like they're coming to town. And oftentimes they're coming to town by making these city governments sign NDAs
mm-hmm.
and, you know, going through shell corporations or with, you know, private credit companies that are financing these things. And it's not until they've broken ground or until, you know, the area is cordoned off from the rest of the town and people say, so what's going to be there? And then they say, oh, actually, this is going to be a Meta facility and, you know, it's going to use, you know, X amount of resources. And people are rightly pissed.
Yeah, I think that the physical manifestation of the sort of change that we have borne on our own shoulders as members of, of this society is being rejected. The dogs don't like the dog food. And the targeting, and we're the dogs, and like, go dogs, I say in this one, because the mendacity that has like been part of the big tech's strategy here, the obfuscation, and the thing that I think seems particularly pernicious is the way they targeted rural communities in this, right? With the expectation that they would take it laying down. With the first part of this episode, we spoke to someone in rural Texas who's like, no, no, no. Like they miscalculated effectively. Like people don't like to see their way of life changing. And this represents a fundamental shift that people do not accept. I am surprised that the grassroots resistance has been so forceful and so unanimous. Are you surprised or do you expect miscalculation from Silicon Valley at this point?
Well, I think there is a miscalculation from Silicon Valley. I think if you look back at the way that a lot of these products that have come out of that region of the country, a lot of it's software, but some of it's like hardware too. It's either been universally kind of embraced, right? We think talking about like the iPhone
yeah.
or whatever, or you know, and people loved it, or the universal embrace of social media, of a lot of software before, you know, a lot of people have soured on it. But there has always been this feeling of, we develop the future and we give it to you. We drop it into you. And then you all sort of figure out what you're going to do with it. But like, our job is to sort of, it's negative to say the word foist, but I think that's really the idea, is we tell you what the next,
it's the elites telling everybody else what they're going to, how they're going to live their lives.
And I do think that this is also to not just like totally characterize everyone in Silicon Valley as a villain. I think there is a thought of like benevolence there, right? Like, we're trying to build amazing things for you and give them to you. And, you know, you can let them enrich your lives. Or I think that's how a lot of people there see it. And so I think there's this thought of like, they'll take what we give them because we're building amazing things. We're smarter. We understand, you know, there's a real feeling of, I think people should be grateful that we're building these things. We're bringing, you know, we're bringing jobs, or we're bringing, you know, tax revenue to these local communities, or we are, you know, we're reindustrializing this area by providing all these construction jobs. And I think in Silicon Valley, there has been a feeling right now that there was this huge miscalculation and this general understanding that they don't know what other people are thinking, because, you know, some of these people have said, well, I guess we just need to give more incentives to these people, like more money to these towns in order to put the data centers in. And then residents of the community will say, more money actually makes us more skeptical. Like, what is this money for? Are you giving us this money because eventually, like, we're not going to be able to drink the water in our town? Yeah. Like, what is the reason here? And they haven't understood that, like, the fundamental problem is that it feels very patronizing and there's no trust there because of, honestly, decades of industry and towns getting screwed over by giant corporations.
Totally. Like, you're in Wisconsin and Janesville and the Meta data center's going in where the Foxconn plant was supposed to be. There are decades of betrayals. And, you know, Silicon Valley may feel it's unfair that they're footing the bill for that, but that's part of the reality here. In addition to a really questionable strategy of secrecy and making people sign NDAs and the general posture, which is, we are Prometheus. You're welcome. Here's your fire. And like, go forth, humanity. You're so lucky that we're in your lives. I kind of wonder, you know, these are universal concerns that we as human beings share. Like, we want agency. We want control, right? But the bipartisan nature of the outrage is surprising to me, really, because nothing else in this broken-ass political system that we have is bipartisan. And I kind of wonder whether part of the reason you see Democrats and Republicans, voters at least, and in some cases candidates, uniting around a distaste or skepticism on data centers is because the issue and even the construction of these things has moved so quickly, and the issue is coming so fast out of the gate that politicians really haven't had big public debates about this. Like, the partisan sort of like spin doctors have not had a chance to sink their teeth into it. Like, everybody's kind of just like shooting from the hip. And so it's not coded Democrat or Republican as yet. And so therefore, you can build a coalition that has people from both sides of the aisle. Do you think that the speed of all of this is part of the reason why it's gained so much strength in a bipartisan fashion?
I think it's, in some sense, the speed. I think, you know,
you don't have to agree with me.
No, I've been talking to different people who cover this issue, and what I found is really interesting. This one reporter, Jael Holzman, who reports for Heatmap News, the climate website, said that when Heatmap News does its surveying of people, the one of the top predictors, if not the top predictor, to opposition for a renewable energy product or data center project is if they voted for Barack Obama for president and then Donald Trump. Like, that is, that was the person
really
who was most likely. And I think that there is, in a sense, a little bit of a, you know, your politics are slightly inscrutable. And also you're very like populistly oriented, right? Towards whatever. Like, I think there is a I think there's just a genuine skepticism of entrenched political power or economic power in any form. And I think that that has been sort of the genesis of this. But I would go even further, and I would say that, like, when you look at the 2020s and just the feeling of deep political angst, I think it is really directed at the idea of, and I know that, like, you know, people on the right who are like MAGA coded aren't, you know, talking about like income inequality, but it's about that. It's about this feeling of being screwed over, of left behind, of, you know, there's no longer like elites and politicians and everyone, companies act with impunity, and there's no way whatsoever to stop that. You know, if you look at some of what frustrates me so much about the AI moment is this idea of like resistance is futile. Everyone's going to use this stuff. You're either going to get left behind and be part of this permanent underclass if you don't do it. And yes, it may take some jobs, but you can't do anything about it. The toothpaste is out of the tube. Deal with it. And in a lot of people's jobs and a lot of people's lives, there is this encroachment of these tools, and people who have a resistance to them feel like, I don't know how to stop this. Data center construction is really the only method of resistance that has been effective towards big tech, but also towards large scale corporations. Like, this is the one thing that people can do, which is go to their city council meeting, get very loud and very mad with a bunch of other people, and then see that it works. And so what I think is, it's less about, you know, no one's been able to like mobilize and form like, you know, the DC based coalition around this or whatever. I think it's just very organically, people are like, I'm pissed off, this works, and I'll take whoever is nearby who wants to help with this. Like, I really think it's that.
I get that, except that like half the people that we're talking about still support Donald Trump. Like, here's someone who's a grifter, whose corruption is breathtaking and happening in plain sight, who's more concerned with a helipad and a ballroom project than the safety and the health and the welfare of the American public, and yet they still support him. So, like, if you do care about the injustice of it, if you do care about getting fucked over, like, why doesn't that extend to other parts of your political persuasion? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's very clear which person is like in the grift, and yet you're going to go after Meta instead. And I mean, maybe it's because big tech exists in a sort of liminal space that isn't as partisan coded as, but I mean, Donald Trump's out there supporting this stuff. Do you think that that matters? Like, he's literally, you know, 96 hours ago, like, we should build more data centers. Like, first of all, what is that, because he loves hanging out with, you know, Tim Cook and Mark Zuckerberg when they feel like it? Or what is that about? Because he's really now at odds with the rest of the party.
I actually don't have enough insight into where Trump stands on all of this in terms of like why he is making that break, why he's not, because, you know, I wonder, too, if this is a little like senioritis from him in some ways. Like,
you mean senioritis, that, like when you're senior year of high school and you don't give a shit anymore, or like kind senior, of like adult and you're like,
both apply. But I would say this is like a little what I've thought about the and I could be completely wrong here, but what I've sometimes thought about the data center opposition is maybe this is what some politics looks like post Donald Trump. Right. Because like this has been a figure who's been so divisive, who has, you know, just totally fractionally split people into, you know, the cult of Donald Trump and those who resist it. It feels a little to me like this may be politics moving past being just centrally about one person and being more about actual like things that are happening to the country.
Wow, that would be amazing.
and I'm not saying that it's a guarantee of something like that, but I do think he's almost a little bit irrelevant in this. Obviously, the president of the United States, he's not irrelevant to industrial policy in the country. But I mean, I think people's political beliefs are first off often very inscrutable. I also think big tech is one of the few like universal targets, right? Because if you look at the way that, you know, Silicon Valley kind of came up in the last, let's say, 12 years, you had these big social media companies coming out. Silicon Valley is proudly liberal.
Totally.
Very like, we are, you know, we are trying to, you know, usher in a very liberal friendly version of the world. And the response to that in Congress from Republicans, Republican lawmakers, was like, okay, these guys are censoring us. They're shadow banning us. They're putting all their, you know, community standards and editorial controls, and they're warping the information environment in a way that is going to be very harmful for you know, for our political project. And that was sort of the way of things until 2016.
Yeah.
And the fallout of that. And then you have the left being like, oh my God, these platforms elected Donald Trump. I think that's incredibly overstated, but you started to see the way that, you know, savvy political actors used these tools in ways to mobilize a large base. You get the whole like fake news, misinformation situation, the Russian trolls, the, you know, what have you. And then it just oscillates back and forth from there, right? Because the tech platforms say, okay, no, we do want to protect this. So they do some stuff. Then the Republicans say, well, you're shadow banning, you're censoring, you're blah, blah, blah. You've got your foot. COVID happens. We go through that whole thing. And then Donald Trump gets elected again. Yeah. And it's basically just like, shut the book. We're done moderating any of this stuff. We don't want to be editors, have editorial control. It's a free for all. So what you have.
And let's go to his inauguration. I mean, it's more than, it's like, let's align ourselves with this administration. Let us go on Joe Rogan in a gold chain and talk about, you know, bow hunting or whatever the fuck Mark Zuckerberg was doing. Let's go and, you know, be there with, you know, our second and third wives in bra tops as Donald Trump puts his hand on the Bible and swears himself in. You know, like, it's a 180 of epic proportions that will not be for, I mean, I do agree with you, it's been oscillation back and forth, but I don't think that big tech comes back from if there's a Democrat in office and is like invited to that inauguration. I think the jig is up. I mean, I do think that we have reached there's a line in the sand, 2024 and beyond, politically speaking, as far as big tech.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I would argue that because of the last 10 years or so of the back and forth, what has happened is that nobody trusts these guys.
Yeah, yeah, right. No.
Nobody thinks they have their best interest at heart. I mean,
except for Donald Trump.
In some ways, what you're describing there of the, you know, everyone on the dais at the inauguration from Silicon Valley, Tim Cook bending the knee in the ways that he has, obviously Elon Musk,
Sundar Pichai
from Google. All of these folks, Jeff Bezos, what Jeff Bezos has done with the Washington Post, obviously, I think that there is a way that it has also shown people, and this is how I think it relates to the data centers, of like, these guys are going to cozy up to whatever power is around, right? Like, they don't have like a ethical standard to any of this. And I think it really matters for the physical incursion part of the data centers, because, you know, one thing that these guys are talking about is, we got to build as many data centers as possible. We have, like, the entire AI boom depends on this. The geopolitical race with China for AI, you know, dominance and national security depends on this. We got to do this. This is going to be so great for your town, so great for whatever. Why aren't people more excited about this? And then in the other side of their mouth, they're like, we need to put data centers on the moon. Like, we need to put the data centers in space. We're going to put the data centers in space.
Yes.
And that sounds science, like sci-fi, right? But it's also a great reason not to trust these guys, because what if they come into your town and dig up a bunch of shit and, you know, and they do cause environmental issues, or in the case of
Charlie,
Elon
what
Musk,
if they end humanity? Like, they concede that this is technology that, like, there's a 49% chance, maybe 50% chance that this destroys civilization. And like, that's like, those are odds that most Americans wouldn't take, but Silicon Valley is asking us to, and also to house the bunkers where this tech will be, you know, run and you know, will help manipulate our human lives.
Yeah, I'm not as I mean, they obviously are talking about the civilizational extinction stuff. I think that that's
overstated.
Very, very overstated.
I get that. But when we talk about the anxieties people feel and the lack of trust, I mean, nobody can guarantee that it's not going to destroy civilization, right? You may assign better odds. But like, if you're talking about decades of betrayal at the hands of the elites and corporations, and that was just about like whether or not there are going to be jobs, the stakes here are enormously high. And that gives, I think, people every reason to be like, beyond NIMBYism, just like, fuck no, hard stop, we're out, or to the degree we can be.
Even from the sense of just like broad surveillance, right? Like, yeah. Like think about like an issue right now that's obviously very popular is the backlash to all the flock cameras, right? That are going on because like police officers are using them to stalk people in their own lives. But yeah. But a broader reason, I think, is the artificial intelligence part of this, right? Because all this stuff, like all these other Silicon Valley products that are surveillance-based, they're collecting all this data. And now we have these machines powered by these data centers with a lot of information that's going to be stored in these data centers that can aggregate this information, can keep it, can put it on file, can cross-reference it with whatever, and then sell it to the government and then use that to do whatever they want it to do. And there's this general idea of like, you know, like when people are thinking about data centers, a line I've seen is that like they're calling them surveillance centers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because it's like the product of this stuff, it does have these high stakes and it doesn't have to be civilizational, you know, paperclip maximizing, you know, Skynet humanity ends. But it could also, it could be, hey, you know, I sped too fast in front of a flock camera one time. And then 5 years later, I talk shit about the government in public and someone is able to look up, you know, my license plate, cross-reference that. Like there's this feeling of all of this data and the ability to analyze it and package it and tag us with whatever, like it's a huge liability and it's all being facilitated by this technology that is being foisted on us without our, you know, necessarily consent or our, you know, our approval. And we don't know how it's going to be used down the road. And so I think that that's just a very big issue that adds to the distrust. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, going back to the reason why I said the data center's on the moon is because there's this idea that these guys yeah. could pack up at any moment and totally change. Like Mark Zuckerberg changed the name of his company from Facebook to Meta about the metaverse, spent tens of billions of dollars on these like legless avatars that looked like shit. And then as soon as it realized nobody's going to use this stuff, pivots to artificial intelligence
yeah.
and pretends like none of that happened. These are the same people who are saying, trust us. We're You're going right. to build these 80 football field sized loud buildings in your town. And we're going to be there for a very long time, even though we just want to put these, you know, in space. It's crazy. Like who would trust these people?
More of my conversation with Charlie in just a moment, but first, the midterm election is less than 70 days away and Democrats have to win back the House of Representatives and probably the Senate to stop Donald Trump's agenda. Vote Save America has identified 12 of the most beatable Republicans up for re-election this year, and they are calling them the Crooked Dozen. Kicking out the Crooked Dozen is doable, but it is going to take every one of you stepping up between now and Election Day. Vote Save America is here with practical actions you can take right now to help win. Sign up at votesaveamerica.com to get all the tools you need to get ready to vote, volunteer, amplify good information, and most importantly, talk to the people in your life and get them to join you. It literally takes 2 seconds. Sign up at votesaveamerica.com. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. VoteSaveAmerica.com. It is not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. Runaway Country is brought to you by Quince. Does anyone else feel like August is the Sunday of summer? It's the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush. And for me, that always starts with my wardrobe and accessories. Quince proves you don't need a crowded closet to look incredible. You just need the right pieces. Quince specializes in effortless, high-quality essentials like ultra-soft organic cotton and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. They are beautifully tailored, built to last, and they transition seamlessly from morning meetings and Zooms to dinner. Quince also has premium stretch denim starting at just $50 with the kind of perfect fit and structure and weight that you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories to cut out the middlemen, so you are paying for quality, not brand markup. I got these awesome hoops on Quince, and I wear them basically every day. If you watch this podcast on YouTube, please subscribe. You can see me wearing them, or on television, or anywhere on the street. If you see me at CVS, I will probably be wearing these because they are classics, and they are so easy to wear, and they are very well made. So upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/runaway. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/runaway. I get what you're saying about the universal distaste for this and the universal mistrust. Do you think nominally, marginally, Democrats have any sort of upper hand here? Maybe just given the reality that of late, Silicon Valley has been aligned with the Trump administration and Trump is still out there doing their bidding, whether knowingly or not, on data centers. Do you think that this is, like, as you look at the landscape, something where Democrats have been more swift in terms of their condemnation and therefore might, I guess, have greater trust among the public as far as this stuff is concerned?
I think so. You know, I think what's so tricky about this is the fact that as much as we're talking about all the reasons why people, you know, should or can distrust big tech or the, you know, the ways that these data centers are concerning, I do think too, like the backlash that we've seen to them sometimes isn't about the facts, right? It's just like the water usage thing has become such a sticky meme that it is like the primary reason for a lot of people to oppose this, despite it kind of not being always true. It's very regionally dependent and place dependent.
Ezra Klein made this point on his podcast, and I think it bears mentioning, if people really want to cut down on water usage, there are a lot of ways to work on that. Maybe don't eat meat. Maybe really focus on like the environmental root causes of water depletion and, you know, water shortages, because AI data centers ain't it.
Right. And obviously that's like really bad political messaging, right? It's like, hey, you care about this topic, but actually you should just go become a vegan, right? Like, obviously it's not good to take a whole bunch of populist anger around something that you could use to your advantage and tell people that,
exactly.
that they're wrong about it. But I do think there is a balance for Democratic politicians to strike, because you don't want to build an entire movement based off of just like social media rage, right? I think that that's just a caveat in all this. But I do think Democrats are better positioned for this. You know, even just a couple of months ago when I was reporting on this, some of the reason why Republicans have been even slower to this has been, they're friendly with the oil and gas industry and the people who are like, hey man, we got to fire up these big coal plants and you know, and use this because like we're not electrified yet. And I think that that has been a little bit of a dance that they have to navigate. And you know, it sounds like in Texas, you know, Greg Abbott is coming out very forcefully against
right after he's data, you know, tried to fast track Texas as the epicenter of the technology.
Right. And so there's a little bit of, I think some of these guys are really getting the message. There was, I think, a group of Republicans talking to the AI industry, basically saying, like, you are going to make this hard for us to win in battleground states if you don't actually, like, you know, change your PR and your messaging. So I do think the Democrats are on better footing with this. I do think it's going to be interesting to watch how this evolves and what are the things, like, what are the areas of actual focus? Like, does it become about environmental stuff? Because that is, you know, one of the most resonant things. Or does it become more about, you know, the oligarchy backlash, the big tech backlash, the getting rid of the money on it. And I do think that they will have to figure out a lane here instead of just saying data center is bad, because I do think the way that all of this stuff goes is eventually the data centers get cleaner, right? They get, you know, more entrenched. Like, the issue could potentially lose some of its political salience. And if you don't know exactly what it is you're fighting against, I think it could just sort of look like, you know, like jumping on the bandwagon, et cetera.
Right. I think one of the reasons why I feel like Democrats have the upper hand on this is because, A, while yes, the environmental piece is something people talk about a lot, I do think of late, especially when you look at Senate races across the country, they're not talking about it in terms of environmental impact. They're talking about it in terms of corporate power, big tech power, and corruption, right? Which is a more resonant message if you're talking about the body politic. But also because part of the solution is inherently like more Democratic than it is Republican, which is greater oversight, greater regulation, like more empowered citizenry, you know, like these are the solutions that the left embraces much more than the right. And I do think that because of that, it's a more natural fit on the left side of the aisle. Although don't ever underestimate the left's ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory on any particular issue. I do think that, you know, you've seen a quicker, a more fleet-footed response from the left on this. They've seized on the issue earlier than the right. And Greg Abbott is a case study in how to convince people that you're completely disingenuous. But we'll see what happens in Texas, right?
It's such a refreshing thing to me to watch. Like, even though, you know, sometimes the arguments are a little bit inscrutable, like, my big frustration. Yesterday, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that was basically revealed to be, you know, written via Claude or, you know, one of these chatbots. And yeah, the, you know, the op-ed editor of the Wall Street Journal was kind of just like, yeah, everyone uses AI now. Like, you know, whatever. Like, it's still his ideas. It's still whatever. And I was really frustrated by this. And encountered when I was talking with other people about it on, you know, places like Twitter or whatever, people just kind of reading me, they're like, oh, stop being such a precious little baby. Like, this is just how this goes, right? Like, yeah, you're a writer, you're going to be precious about these things. And I think where I netted out at the end of the day, when I really thought about what bothered me about this, like, I don't really care if, you know, like, no fancy person writes their own op-eds. They have people who do that for them. So, like, AI is your ghostwriter. It's not like some crazy scandal or paradigm shift. Like, I don't care about the individual instance. What I care about so much is this idea that people are saying, here's what the future is, and you have no say in it.
Yeah.
You have no voice in this. You must just go along with it. You can't protest this because it's stupid if you do. And what this whole movement is people saying, no, I do get a say. I do get a voice. Like, we very well, you know, may not be able to stand athwart this, but I'm going to try. I'm going to do something. And that is democracy.
Totally.
And that is the thing that Silicon Valley hates. That is the thing that so many people right now with power hate. And I think this is why, even if you don't agree with every tenet of the data center backlash, you should agree with that fundamental notion that we all get a say in how this is deployed.
Small d democracy. I find something really exhilarating in it. You know, it's a real rejoinder to the like expectation that we're going to take it all laying down. You feed the dogs the dog food and they don't get to bark back. Well, wrong. Okay, I want to end on this because we spent this time talking about like the resistance effectively. But like, how fucked are we if it actually succeeds from a tech perspective, right? I mean, because the counter to this, forgetting like, oh, you're going to have a higher tax base, yada, 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 money's going to flow to your community. The flip, I think the most compelling argument for these data centers is like, hey, look, we can do it here and you can all have access to this information, or we're going to do it in space or in China, and then it's going to be proprietary, or, you know, the benefits of the information age will flow to the elites and not you. And it really will create a permanent underclass and or, you know, deeply cripple America's ability to compete in a global way in the 21st century. Like, how legit do you think that is?
I think we're going to have data set. Like, we had data centers before this. Like the internet, it is the internet's infrastructure, right? So you're going to have these things regardless, like whether they're you know, in a different country or not. I think it's about, again, I think it's this fight is more about over the say of how these things are deployed in service of what. Are we building them recklessly? Like a part of this conversation that we haven't even gotten into because it's so complicated is there are a lot of economic fears about the AI boom, about, yeah, you know, like
that's for the Galaxy Brain podcast, not Runaway Country.
about a bubble, about, you know, the notion that we're investing all this basically out of FOMO or fear of, you know, needing to beat China, and that the technology is not improving, you know, commensurately with investment, or, you know, these companies aren't going to figure out how to actually generate the revenue needed over a long period of time to sustain this. And then what happens when the bubble bursts, right? It's not just that these towns lose, you know, the projects that they have. It's that all of this stuff starts to go away. And then the, you know, the economy, which is basically like propped up on NVIDIA and a couple of other companies, you know, falters. And then there's, you know, massive job loss and unemployment that AI couldn't even dream to usher in. And so I think that, you know, that's just a big part of this calculus. Like, how fucked are we? The thing that I think about with this that gives me a lot of pause is that if the AI industry succeeds in building, you know, whatever, it's artificial general super intelligence type thing that is so good, that is, you know, better than most and all humans at any job or task, that is going to create a rewiring of the global economy in such a way that there will be tremendous fallout. I don't know how to predict what that would look like, but it would be crazy if humans, if we can't answer the question, what is a human for? It's going to be super chaotic. But if they invest money on the promise that they are going to deliver that, and then they don't deliver that, there is also going to be economic fallout and a real issue when people finally say, like, okay, well, the juice isn't worth the squeeze here. So let's, you know, let's stop the money from flowing. Let's pull the plug on X, Y, and Z. And so I think we are in a position right now, a position that is caused by, you know, growth at all costs capitalism and a lot of greed and a lot of like FOMO as an investment strategy. And also these companies selling a future that I think, you know, is not clear is going to come to pass. I think we are in a situation that feels like we are a little bit damned if we do and a little bit damned if we don't right now. And I think the way that I would describe the data center backlash is as a governor on all of that, right? Like, I don't think people are saying, do not build a single data center, do not do anything. Like, the idea of a moratorium, which certain, you know, politicians are putting forward, is an effort to say, like, let's take stock of what it is, like, what are we doing here, right? Is this sustainable? Is this what we want? Is this a good way forward? And I think there are a lot of people who can probably even at the end of the day be swayed on some of this stuff, right? Oh, we took a pause. People are able to communicate that some of these data centers aren't as scary or bad as they thought. They actually do want the benefits of some of this technology. But right now, you know, it is a truck with no brakes going down the ramp, right? Like people are scared of what could possibly happen because it seems like everyone is asleep at the wheel and just like more, keep
faster,
going.
Faster.
Yeah.
So kind of fucked.
Yeah. I don't know. This is tough. I feel like I end every podcast and people are just like, okay, I'm going to go stare in the middle distance for 45 minutes.
No, I think we got some real conclusions and some deep, incisive analysis, which is exactly what I expected from you, Charlie Worsell. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with me today. I told you I was like scared to tackle this one because it's deep and tech and complicated, but events of the last several days have made it impossible to avoid. And something tells me we are going to be talking about this a lot more in the next 2 years.
I think so.
So expect the phone call again, my friend, when we have another deep dive on this subject.
I'm always around.
Charlie, thank you. It is great to see you. It is even better to speak with you. We hope to see you soon.
We'll talk soon.
That's our show for this week. Please don't forget to check out the show and our rapid response videos on our YouTube channel, Runaway Country with Alex Wagner. It is a pretty awesome channel, if I say so myself. And if you are somehow not sick of me yet, take a gander at my Substack, How the Hell with Alex Wagner. Last but not least, if you have been impacted directly by the Trump administration or its policies, please send us an email or a one-minute voice note at runawaycountry@crooked.com, and we may be in touch to feature your story. Big thanks to everyone who has written in already. Runaway Country is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Alona Minkowski, Emma Illick Frank, Haley Jones, and Anisha Banerjee, with help from Eric Shute, Kenny Moffitt, and Charlotte Landis. Production support from Ben Hethcote, Katie Long, Adrian Hill, and Matt DeGroat. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.